Radio influence. The future is now.
Why, Crusher, it's good to see you.
Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crushell. Get in on the talent grid and text Crush at 10-12-60 with your questions, comments, or smart-ass remarks.
And welcome to Crush Performance, everybody. I am Jeff Crushell. The con man is here keeping us on track, and we're your weekly source for performance information. So if you want to get in contact with us, the website is crushperformance.com. Write to us there. Sign up for our blogs, get our newsletters, and all the hookups to the world of sport performance, crushperformance.com. On Twitter, at Jeff Crush. And if you're on the Facebook, we're doing some cool things there as well. Join our membership. You can join our page or just get onto our page, Crush Performance. We're just sharing the good word, and that's what it's all about. Today, I'm really excited because we continue our War on Sugar, our first War on Sugar episode for 2018, and I wanted to kick it off with a bang. And I also wanted to go back a little retro to sort of reset as we look at our 2018 War on Sugar campaign, to sort of set the tone and get everybody back on track as to why we do this, to raise awareness and help people understand the simple things you can do to improve your health and the health of your children. Well, one thing we always say on the show, if you want to solve a problem, you better accurately define the problem. And that might be one of the issues here, because when it comes to our health and our overall weight in general, we're losing ground. We're almost going backwards. And where should we be focusing our efforts? Well, for me, it's got to be on our children, the next generation. If we don't turn this around for our next generation, we're going to be in big trouble in more ways than one. And I'm not just talking about you and me and the health of our children. I'm talking about the financial stress on our healthcare systems. There's research out there that used to point at obesity and the health-related issues of just being overweight and obese and the strain it's going to cause on the healthcare systems globally. And then the focus turned to diabetes. What will diabetes do to a healthcare system if it keeps increasing at the rate that it is? And then the long-term health-related issues associated with diabetes, especially when it gets to the elderly population. Devastating. And some research predicted that diabetes by itself has the power to wipe out every single healthcare system on the planet. And then the research on brain health started coming out, and the look at Alzheimer's, and maybe the new definition of Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes. The fact that high glycemic, high sugar diets are showing the potential in scientific research to accelerate and maybe even cause some of the symptoms associated with the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's, brain health in general. Well, one study pointed out that you can reduce your risk of Alzheimer's, whether you're genetically predisposed or not, by 52% by simply changing your daily diet. Important stuff. And when we go back to the research, again, we always say, if you want to solve a problem, you better understand a problem. And getting a picture of what's happened in the past can help you understand how we got to the point where we're at. And that's what the show is all about today. Today we will talk with Dr. Ashley Skinner from Duke University. Her and her group have done the great work on monitoring and scaling and painting the picture of childhood obesity trends. They've released this study for the last few years. It's the prevalence of obesity and severe obesity in children. Their latest research is out. We're going to talk to them today about that research, why it's so important, and what they found in this recent round of the latest data they have on children. And it's alarming. It's really alarming and scary, especially when we look at the age groups of 2 to 5 years of age. Stay tuned for that. And then later in the show, I want to go back to a very important conversation we had, because it's sort of the no BS version. It's one of my favorite people when it comes to the fight on obesity and our war on sugar, Dr. Yanni Friedhoff. In 2014, he published his book, The Diet Fix, Why Diets Fail and How to Make Yours Work. There's just great information in there, and he just doesn't pull any punches. He's a huge advocate of childhood diets, and he is an adversary to the big food companies who market directly to our children. Just one of the great leaders in this war on sugar, for sure. I want to go back to that conversation. It's worthy of a listen to reset the tone, as I mentioned, and get us set for our 2018 War on Sugar campaign. And just to give you an idea of why we've waged war on sugar here at Crush Performance, a few years ago, the United States Department of Agriculture reported that the average adult consumes between 150 and 170 pounds of refined sugars in 1 year. Most of that, ladies and gentlemen, is hidden in the everyday foods you eat. Your yogurts, your granola bars, your cereals, your dinners, your snacks. It's estimated we consume 22 teaspoons of added sugar a day, and soft drinks are public enemy number one when it comes to extra calories and absolutely no nutrition. In fact, if we go back to 1822, the average adult ate the amount of sugar found in one of today's 12-ounce sodas every 5 days. Today, we eat that much every 7 hours. If that's not a good enough reason to wage war on sugar, I don't know what is. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Crush War on Sugar. It continues right after this. Stick around. Crush Performance, we're your weekly source for performance information. Join me, Jeff Kershaw, and the Con Man as we dig deep into the science and research of talent development and skill acquisition to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it really takes to achieve human maximum performance. And go to our website, crushperformance.com, to get details on my brand new book, The Performance Plan, strategies for top performance in sport, business, coaching, and life. Our goal is to help you get better, and it starts with the performance plan. Get control, get focused, and get results. We're Crush Performance. Join us weekly right here on Radio Influence.
You're listening to Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Get the Crush blogs, podcasts, and performance links at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Crush Performance, everybody. Today, we are continuing the Crush War on Sugar. Thanks for joining in. Again, if you have any questions, comments, smart remarks, or if you have any ideas, research, or stories you want us to look into, let us know. Get to us at crushperformance.com. We'll definitely answer your email. We answer every email we get. And if we really love your topic, we may dedicate a segment of the show or an entire episode to your idea. So we'd love to hear from you for sure. Today, as I mentioned, the War on Sugar continues. And when we go back to when we started the War on Sugar, the inspiration was my mom, who had early onset Alzheimer's, and we were looking for answers as to why this happened so rapidly and so quickly. And there's just too much overwhelming evidence linking high glycemic, high sugar diets to degenerative brain disease. The research is out there, and we've had it on the show before. We will visit some of the new research on brain health and diet this year on the Crush War on Sugar. Some very, very powerful things. So stay tuned for that for sure. But it was my mother and two little hockey players that I wound up standing behind at a little convenience store one day. They were all dressed up in their hockey equipment. And when they turned around to leave, as I was standing behind them, one of them was holding a giant liter sport drink and a chocolate bar. And the other little player was holding a large can of energy drink and a bag of chips. And I had to stop these two young players. They might have been 9-10 years of age, you know, little heavier set boys. And I said, "Boys, do your parents know what you're buying here?" And they're looking at me like, "Stranger danger." And the attendant behind the counter, the cashier behind the counter, is looking at me like, "Hey, dude, what's up?" And I was just taken back, people, because, you know, I know people think the energy drinks give you energy and the sport drinks are good for you. But we had two little 10-year-old guys with their hockey equipment heading off to practice or a game doing the absolute worst thing they could possibly be doing, not just for their performance in their game and their practice, but for their health. And I just couldn't take it anymore, and we started the war on sugar. Shortly after that happened, there was an unbelievably powerful expose in 2014 in McLean's magazine. The feature was Death by Sugar, how the sweet killer is fueling the biggest health crisis of our time, and it is. And I'm telling you right now, unless we get up in front of it, we're in big trouble. Well, we know that if we're going to solve a problem, we have to clearly understand the problem. And for the last few years, we've had the opportunity to get a really good overview of what's happening in terms of obesity in our children, thanks to the great work of Dr. Ashley Skinner and her group from Duke University. They've laid out time and time again a study going back to 1999 where there was some really good normative data on children's health, weight, and body mass index. And they've been mapping it forward year after year. In 2014, her research really hit mainstream as the childhood obesity epidemic came into the spotlight, into the forefront. And it's called The Prevalence of Obesity and Severe Obesity in Children. Well, her research just came out for 2016, and it's not good. The trends are not going in the right direction, and there's an alarming spike in our youth. And joining us right now to talk about that research is Dr. Ashley Skinner. Dr. Skinner, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to the Crush War on Sugar, and I'm glad to have you joining our ranks here as we just try to spread the good word and raise awareness on all the issues related to health, but specifically, you know, it started out as an attack on sugar and the amount of sugar we're consuming and the incredible effects that's having on our health. And your research falls right into the scope of this. So when we saw your new paper come out on the prevalence of obesity and severe obesity in U.S. children, we had to get a hold of you. Maybe to start this off, give us a little background and what drove you to this area of study, Dr. Skinner.
So I've been very interested in obesity in children for a long time. The work that I've done has often been, let's look at these big national data sets and see, are we getting, you know, is obesity getting worse? What sort of comorbidities do kids have, meaning what other conditions do they have, like high cholesterol or high blood pressure, and just sort of trying to understand this problem.
Well, when we look back to your study, the one from 2014, you looked at sort of the trends and the rates of different levels of obesity and overweight from 1999 to 2014. Let's go back to that study because that one kind of was groundbreaking at the time because it gave us an overview. And Dr. Skinner, maybe even before we go there, one thing I'd like to just sort of talk about with your work and why it's so important for everybody who's listening here is to get a good picture of what's going on. We often say, you know, even when we're working with our athletes or our organizations, a problem accurately defined is easily solved or at least, you know, partially solved in the first place. And I think that's kind of the piece of the puzzle you're putting together here. You're giving us a real accurate broad stroke picture of what's really happening out there and the trends over a long period of time. And that's an important piece of the puzzle, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's incredibly important to understand that, like, all obesity is not the same, or all, you know, kids who are overweight are not the same. Like, there's kids who have just a little bit overweight, right? And then there's kids who have really severe obesity, and those are completely different problems. And so understanding what those look like really help us, you know, determine what we can do for them.
Yeah, and maybe help plan out strategies to attack this big issue, which has turned out to be a formidable opponent when it comes to, you know, kind of getting ahead of this big issue. When we look at your data from 1999 to 2014, I think it gave us a really good picture of what was going on. And I think it sort of spurred on some real thought as to how we might be able to attack this monster.
Yeah, I mean, we've known and seen for quite a while that, you know, at least in the U.S., obesity is going up. Certainly in other countries around the world, obesity is also rising. And you know, there were some signs from certain studies and in certain age groups that maybe we were seeing some improvements or some reductions. And that, you know, the study from that went through 2014 showed it's actually still sort of going up for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that for children, there was a 17.4% increase in class 1 obesity, 6.3% in class 2. And there was actually, in the big picture, no evidence of a decline despite all the initiatives that have been out there. And I think, you know, some of the big pushes to raise awareness on the issues. I think one of the big things that we'll be facing here in the near future is just the cost of healthcare, as you mentioned, I think, in one of the studies. And I think that would be a real big push to make some major moves forward. When you looked at the latest data from 1999 to 2016, were there any surprises for you and your group?
So the one finding that really stood out was obesity in children who were 2 to 5 years old. So these young preschoolers are the ones where we thought we were potentially seeing the biggest decline and maybe getting some real improvement. And we saw a huge jump from the last years of data that we had. And, you know, it's up to now 13, almost 14% with class one obesity in this really young age category. And that was really important to us because that's the group we want. I mean, we obviously want to improve obesity for all kids, but making sure we don't develop obesity in those youngest kids is super important because the younger we can keep it from happening, the less likely they are to develop it.
Yeah,
if kid has obesity when they're young, they'll probably have it the rest of their life.
Yeah, there's no question. And I agree with you. It's such an important age group to attack, that 2 to 5 years old. We're talking with Dr. Ashley Skinner, adjunct associate professor at Duke University, talking about her study, the prevalence of obesity and severe obesity in children. Dr. Skinner, you guys use the body mass index as sort of your guide to, I guess, determine the obesity rates. There's been a lot of speculation on the accuracy and the meaningful data that comes out of using a BMI to predict, you know, overall obesity and weight in general. Maybe just explain to us why the body mass index was used in your studies.
Yeah, so the body mass index is, you know, absolutely one of those measures we talk about a lot and what it's good for. So as a lot of people know, body mass index doesn't actually tell you it just tells you how much you weigh compared to how tall you are.
Right.
It doesn't tell you anything about how much of it is muscle or how much of it is fat or anything of that nature. So when we're looking at a big population, so when we're looking at all of the people in the United States, for example, body mass index is pretty good at helping us understand what obesity looks like. It's not so clear for an individual person. So when an individual child, for example, is over the 95th percentile on the growth charts, that classifies them as having obesity, but there's a lot more that you would probably want to know. Like you would want to also know, well, is this a kid who's active? Is this a kid that we think it's muscle mass or is it fat? Like it's definitely not a straightforward measure for an individual person.
I like it. And that clears it up quite a bit because, you know, there's a lot of issues with the body mass index. So as you mentioned, when we look at individuals, but in terms of the group setting, that clears it up quite nicely. Very good. If we look at back at this group, age group of 2 to 5 years of age, this is very, very concerning. You would think with all the education and data that we now have, we would be making a move forward. And for me and, you know, some of the studies that are out there, this is a critical generation in terms of turning this around, just in terms of the stress on the healthcare system. Dr. Skinner, so what do you think, you know, when you guys look at all the data, what could possibly be going wrong? How could we be going the wrong way when it comes to controlling our child's obesity?
Yeah, so most of what I can really speculate here on what I think is happening. I don't think we have the actual answers there. You know, I think that we got very excited that we were having an effect. And like it or not, when we think we've solved a problem, we're less likely to keep working on that problem. And so I think that's one possible thing that we saw happen, that, oh, this is getting better, and so there was less work put towards it. Another thing is maybe we're just not doing enough, and this is probably even more likely than the other one, which is these kids live complex lives. Every kid lives a complex life, right? Like they're at home and then they're at school and they might have preschool and they have other activities and then they're with friends or family. And if you change what's happening in daycare or in preschool, that only changes that one little part of a kid's life. So I think we haven't necessarily captured everything that we need for these kids in order to address obesity.
Yeah, well, you know, you have an interesting perspective because you've looked at the big picture here. Is there any big picture solutions in your mind that sort of come to mind, even if you're speculating here, that might help steer us in the right direction? Because, boy, I like the idea of, you know, attacking these smaller groups, but it doesn't really help us with the big picture, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't. You know, I don't know that there is one big picture thing. I mean, there's certainly been significant changes in our food supply and the kind of foods that we eat. And I think that could be a major change, is shifting the food supply. But even that's not a straightforward change, right?
Right.
I mean, we can change, you know, sugar consumption. We can find ways to discourage drinking sodas. You know, I think that's definitely a huge factor here. But we also have to find ways for kids to be physically active. And there's so many pieces to that that it's very hard to like say, here's the one solution that could work.
Yeah, it would seem to me the school system is just sort of at the epicenter of this whole thing. What a powerful tool that could be if we could somehow fund and really utilize the school system for exercise and education on nutrition that kids can bring home. I think it would have to take a massive nationwide assault. But this could be something that might be worth looking into and maybe putting a little more effort into as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I know in the U.S. that we are seeing significant declines in how many children are participating in physical education. I know my kids in elementary school, at a good elementary school, only get physical education once a week. They do get some recess each day, but there's definitely been sort of a decline in that. And I think there's some pushback. I definitely think that people are demanding that and they want that for their kids. And schools are still struggling of how do we implement that? How do we ensure kids are getting all the reading that they need? And how do we afford good physical education?
Yeah, it is a balancing act, isn't it? We're talking with Dr. Ashley Skinner from Duke Clinical Research Institute at Duke University. Well, now that you've finished this last round of data and testing, moving forward, what would you like to see? What would you and your group like to look at and learn to help maybe steer this in the right direction?
Yeah, so a lot of the work that my group is doing is focusing on those kids with more severe forms of obesity. You know, I definitely am concerned and worry about kids who are overweight or have what we think of as class 1 obesity. But those kids with class 2 and class 3 obesity are the ones that we really start to worry about. Are they already having, you know, high blood pressure and high cholesterol and issues now while they're children? And, you know, those are the ones that are also the hardest to change. You know, if a kid is overweight, you can make small changes and it might really have a big impact. But kids with severe obesity, you have to make big changes. So we're thinking of, like, how do we connect, you know, the healthcare system with communities, with, you know, parks and recreation departments so that, you know, kids have opportunities to go play and learn and do that with other kids that look like them.
Yeah. For our audience, Dr. Skinner, can you just maybe clear up how you identify or quantify class 2 and class 3 severe obesity? Class 1, as we mentioned, I think was above the 95th percentile in their age category. So class 2 and class 3 must be something severely different than that.
Right. So it's actually complicated. I'll give it in terms of how we think of it for adults. So it's actually a percentage of that 95th percentile. What it essentially is, you know, kids are at different weights at different ages, but it's essentially the equivalent of, we consider an adult having obesity if they have a BMI of 30, and they have class 2 obesity if it's a BMI of 35. So what we have is essentially the equivalent of an adult with a BMI of 35 for class 2 and a BMI of 40 for class 3.
Right. Okay. So very simple math in the end of the day, once you split everybody into their groups. So that's interesting to know. So for parents out there who might have a youngster who they're concerned about, what are some of the things they should be thinking about? I mean, obviously, healthcare professionals can only help them so far. But in your research and data, have you guys seen any strategies that have worked better than others?
Yeah. So by far, the most important thing is that everything has to be based around the whole family.
Right.
And, you know, this obesity can become a particular problem in a family where you have one child who struggles with their weight and one who does not, because then the child who's struggling with weight feels singled out. And even beyond that, none of the changes that you try to make for one kid, like if you say, you know, the child with obesity can't have sodas anymore, that's never going to be a long-term solution if other people in the house are also drinking sodas. So you have to make decisions and changes for your family as a whole. If you want to increase activity, what can the family do together? You know, is that, you know, what you do on the weekends, and do you go on walks after school or when you get home from work? And, you know, making healthier food decisions and doing those for your whole family, because that's good for the kids who may already be struggling with weight. It's good for kids who aren't struggling with weight to help them develop healthy habits so they don't develop a weight problem.
Yeah, I agree that family sort of oriented approach is really important. One of the things that we've done, and I know that we've recommended to a lot of our families, is to start cooking with your kids. I mean, such a simple, simple thing, but you can cook some really healthy, good food and educate your kids at the same time, and plus have some great family time just by cooking together in the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that we recognize, especially in, we treat a pretty poor population here at Duke, is you know, that's hard and it takes time. But once you learn the skills, it's actually a lot of fun. And so it's, you know, recognizing, well, it's kind of hard to cook, especially if you're an adult who hasn't cooked a whole lot yourself before. But once you learn some of it, it can be really enjoyable. It gives you, you know, a chance to spend quality time with your child instead of feeling like, here's all the things I have to do.
Yeah, no question, Dr. Skinner. So, all right. Thanks so much for this. Moving forward, are you guys looking for the next period now, collecting the data and just monitoring the trends? You guys are the watchdogs now for the obesity rates in the society. So I'm pretty interested to see if you guys are back at it already.
Yeah, so the data are actually collected by the U.S. government, and they release the data and make it available to researchers. So absolutely, we keep our eye on it, and every time new data come up, we present these kinds of trends.
Oh, great stuff. Well, thank you so much for your time today, and I want to pass on a thank you to your whole team for the work that you do. It's really great to be able to see these numbers and get a picture, a big picture of what's going on out there to help us, I guess, develop strategies to help overcome this big issue we're facing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there you go. A great overview of what is happening with our children in terms of their weight, obesity, severe obesity based on body mass index. A great research by Dr. Skinner and her group. Ladies and gentlemen, we are losing this battle and we're losing ground at a rapid pace. So we had better somehow figure out a way to turn it around. And I have a funny feeling it's going to come down to some very simple principles. What we do on a daily basis. Coming up after the break, I want to go back to a very special interview we had with Dr. Yanni Friedhoff about his book, The Diet Fix. We need to listen to this interview. We need to listen to experts like this because we have to turn this around. More Crush War on Sugar right after this.
Find out what it takes to be a top performer. Get the Crush blog, podcast, and newsletter at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Crush Performance, everybody. Today, we continue to battle and fight the good fight with the Crush War on Sugar. Coming off a great conversation with Dr. Ashley Skinner of Duke University, they've done a really good job of giving us an overview of what's happening in terms of the obesity trends over the years. And again, to get a good idea on how to solve a problem, you have to have a very clear idea of what that problem is. And that's exactly what Dr. Skinner and her team has done for us. They've laid out the trends when it comes to obesity and overweight, and I think the most alarming statistic to come out of the recent round of research is the data on 2 to 5 year olds. The remarkable increase in severe obesity in that age group does not bode well for anybody. So where do we start? Well, you know, it comes back to what we eat on a daily basis. And a few years ago, we had a great conversation with Dr. Yanni Friedhoff about his new book, The Diet Fix, Why Diets Fail and How to Make Yours Work. It's a real important conversation, and I wanted to go back to this as we sort of set the tone for the 2018 assault for the Crush War on Sugar, because this sort of sets the tone. We need to take a daily approach, but we also need to be very aware of how it's going to work for us individually in our daily plan. Here's that great conversation with Dr. Friedhoff. Well, we're here for one main cause, and that's to talk about the great new book that you have out, The Diet Fix, Why Diets Don't Work and How to Fix Your Diet. And I think that's great. But for people who have been interested in following you, the weightymatters.ca is sort of your website/blog. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to encourage everybody to go there and follow that because it's an interesting read. And some of your most recent posts are actually very, very interesting. When you talk about, for instance, the Fraser Institute and their special stupid on obesity. I just find it fascinating the approach that, you know, all these major institutes take when it comes to nutrition and health. And yet, you know, when we look at the science and compare the two, it really doesn't match up. And that's what we get out of a lot of your blogs on Weighty Matters.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of interest out there. And so not every person or organization is working simply for the good or the health and welfare of people and Canadians. They have vested interests, and in regard to the Fraser Institute, there's no question their vested interest is supporting corporations and privatizing healthcare. And I think that that's the way they approach this issue, and clearly it's different than the way I might approach the issue where my only concern is the health of our patients.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and it's weightymatters.ca for anybody who wants to go on there. I think one of my favorite posts of all time is juice is not a blankety-blank-blank fruit. Straight to the point and quite definitive in your meaning here. It's one of my favorite posts of all time.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, juice is one of those things where people think that it's good for you because it once was distantly related to things that grew on trees, but ultimately, it's just sugar water, and people sometimes scratch their heads and think I'm nuts when I talk about it that way, but if I put the exact same amount of vitamins and minerals that you'd find in a glass of juice and a glass of Coca-Cola, I don't think anybody would mistake that for healthful. Ultimately, that's what juice is, because drop per drop, it's the same amount of calories, same amount of sugar as Coca-Cola, and worse than Coca-Cola is people think it's healthy, so nobody mistakes Coca-Cola for a healthy beverage, but plenty of folks drink juice believing that they're doing something good for their bodies.
Yeah, and it's so true. It's Dr. Yanni Fridoff joining us, the founder of Ottawa's Bariatric Medical Institute. You know, Dr. Fridoff, it's interesting. You mentioned sort of the food industry and the government and marketing and that sort of twisted tale of how all those, I guess, organizations work together. And the bottom line is right, money. You mentioned it earlier with a lot of these organizations. Their idea is to make money, but it's interesting to note, when we look at the healthcare system, you know, a lot of these preventable issues that we're seeing in terms of health related to diet and exercise, you know, they're very preventable, but yet we're at the mercy of these massive marketing campaigns as a general public. But yet, you know, these health issues are crippling the healthcare dollar.
It's true. And, you know, the argument you generally hear, that I generally hear out there, is the one that, well, you know, we can all just say no, and we can all just eat less and move more. And if those sorts of, you know, thoughts and directives were useful, I think we'd all be slim. If there was, you know, guilt and shame, if they were sufficient to make people lose weight, we would have all lost weight. At the end of the day, we're discussing billions and billions and billions of dollars that their sole purpose is to get us to consume, consume, consume. I don't think it's a fair fight. I really don't. There's hundreds of dietary decisions we make each and every day, and yet we have a world that is telling us, and really like a current pushing us towards calories. If you want to remain healthy in this day and age, it requires a skill set. It's not the default. On the other hand, once upon a time, back when there was less of an issue with diet and weight-relatable illnesses, it was because the default back then didn't cause gain, and just freely living in the world, it helped most people maintain a pretty healthy body weight. Nowadays, that's changed quite a lot.
We're talking with Dr. Yanni Fridoff. Well, you're so right. You know, when we talk about some of the statistics out there, weight-related diseases have taken over from smoking as the number one preventable cause of death. And that to me is scary. And we do need resources. And one of the great resources out there is something that you've provided, thankfully, is your new book, The Diet Fix, Why Diets Fail and How to Make Yours Work. This is a great read. Congratulations, first of all, on the book and all the success it's been seeing.
Thank you. I mean, it's certainly a labor of love. It's difficult when you've got a full-time job plus a full-time family to find time to write. But this was something that had been pulling me to the keyboard for years, and I'm thrilled that it was finally released, and even more thrilled that it's been received so fondly.
And it's so needed as well. If we look at some of the stats that are out there, for example, the fact that 90% of all diets fail, and people with weight to lose, you know, which is about two-thirds of our population right now, about 60% have tried more than six times to lose weight, and of those, 34% have tried 20 plus times, and 66% of those have tried countless times they can't even remember. Diets don't work, Dr. Fridoff, so what are we to do out there when, you know, we're bombarded daily with all these miracle cures for weight management?
Well, I think the thing that listeners need to remember is that we're not going to suffer forever when it comes to something as important to us as food. So food isn't just fuel. Food is comfort. Food is celebration. We've been using that as a species, food for comfort and celebration forever. For comfort, it actually affects our body's stress hormone levels. And for celebration, there's archaeologic evidence that's 12,500 years old that suggests that we've been feasting for celebratory reasons for a long, long time. Yet many of the modern day diets that we've got out there, they're predicated on not using food in that capacity, on undereating, on overexercising, on being hungry, on cutting out entire food groups, on avoiding the foods we love most in life. And while all of those approaches will help people in the short run, if a person's going to lose weight and keep it off for the long run, which I think is far more valuable and important, well, they need to like their lives, and to like your life, you need to be able to use food like a normal human being. including sometimes for comfort and celebration.
We're talking with Dr. Yanni Friedhoff, assistant professor at the University of Ottawa and the founder of Ottawa's Non-Surgical Bariatric Medical Institute. Well, it's interesting because you're right. You know, about the diet industry right now sort of cashes in around $60 billion in North America alone. And, you know, it's just not working for a lot of people, as you mentioned. But something that comes out of your blog and your writings quite often is the idea that, you know, do we need to treat this obesity and weight management situation more as a medical service or attack it from a medical standpoint? And yet, you know, we talk to a lot of people in the know, and it seems like the doctors aren't really trained classically to deal with this sort of a scenario.
No, I mean, it's getting better, but certainly when I went to medical school in the 1990s, and there was no teaching really whatsoever on weight management and very little on nutrition, and certainly none of it practical in terms of dealing with real-world people with real-world lives in front of you. It really boiled down to being taught to tell people to, you know, eat less and move more, which is as useful as, you know, an economics class that teaches people to buy low and sell high. They're both truisms, but they get us nowhere. And so back when I started my practice as a family physician, I had to seek out my own education in regard to weight management and nutrition. Because again, despite the fact it is, as you mentioned, the number one preventable cause of death in North America, died in weight-related illness, and they're separate overlapping circles, those two things, by the way. They're not one and the same.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that I had to learn about a condition that affects a huge percentage of my patients is strange. I mean, I learn more about conditions statistically I will never see in my lifetime as a physician than I did about this that we see each and every day.
Well, isn't it interesting? Because it's there right there. You know, we're looking at 2/3 of the population right now who are, you know, dealing with issues and the stress in the healthcare dollar. Doesn't it make sense to maybe medicalize the whole situation dealing with overweight and obesity? Does it make sense to you?
Well, so I think so. I mean, it is a bit of a tough thing, and semantics and how things are couched and phrased matter. I do think that obesity is a medical condition. I do think that doctors should be trained better or trained at all in terms of how to manage the condition. But I think what's important is that if we think about it more as a medical condition, perhaps slowly we'll move the needle in society from the narrative that this is just about sloth and gluttony. You know, that is not what's going on. People are not going to bed at night thinking to themselves, you know what, hot damn, I'm going to try to gain another pound tomorrow. I'm going to eat more crap tomorrow because I want to do that. It's not the way it works. This is not a personal choice problem. Of course, there is the ability of a person to make changes and choices that will help them with their weight. But that's true about virtually every chronic medical problem we've got out there. 80% of our chronic medical conditions we can prevent through lifestyle change. That includes most cancers. It includes heart disease. It includes diabetes. It includes high cholesterol levels. And yet it is only with weight where we as a society feel morally righteous enough to say, you know what, that's your problem. You did this to yourself. I think we need to get over ourselves in that capacity. We need to appreciate that we haven't had an epidemic loss of willpower in society, but rather our society and the world around us has changed. And if we want to see some changes in regard to weight and health and nutrition in Canadians, we need to change the world we're growing up in, rather than trying to encourage each and every Canadian to try to figure out how to do this on their own.
Great stuff. We're talking with Dr. Yanni Friedhoff, author of The Diet Fix, Why Diets Fail and How to Make Yours Work. And of course, the website is weightymatters.ca where you can get Dr. Friedhoff's blog. Well, let's talk about this management. Let's talk about this solution. And your book is one of them. You know, we often say in the sporting world, Dr. Friedhoff, you know, if we want to figure out what to do, look to the pros because they're probably doing it right. Well, there's this interesting group of people in our society that have, you know, gone on to lose weight and maintain this weight loss over a period of time. And it's all collected in your book. It's the weight control registry. There's a lot to be learned from this group of people. And I think, you know, that's something that everybody should consider.
So when I opened my practice, I have an office in Ottawa that we opened in 2004, and we exclusively work in non-surgical weight management there. When I opened up to sort of create my program and approach, I studied this group of individuals that you mentioned, the National Weight Control Registry. So these are individuals who have lost weight and, more importantly, kept their weight off. And the average person, and there's over 10,000, I believe, registrants at this point, the average registrant in this group has lost 66 pounds and kept them off for 5.5 years. So they are very, very good at what they do. And what struck me was a few things. One is that they lost weight all sorts of different ways. So the Diet Fix, my book, and my practice in general, I'm not beholden to one particular approach. I think that there's different strokes for different folks in the diet world, and it is important to respect that. But more important were there were some very specific commonalities to their success. And the biggest was keeping track, you know, keeping some sort of record of dietary intake, whether it's a food diary, whether it's keeping track of carbohydrates or calories. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And they were, as a majority of them, were keeping track in some capacity. And it fits with the fact that we've done studies on food diarizing that show that people who keep food diaries lose twice as much weight as people who don't keep food diaries. Twice as much is a lot for a behavior that takes 1 or 2 minutes of effort a day once you're good at it, especially with our apps. So keeping a food diary is crucial. Liking your life is crucial. Obviously, it's about control. It's about minimizing hunger, which involves how you organize the times that you eat, making sure you don't eat too little, making sure you always include protein. You know, hunger is an enemy, and preventing that is a key component of the Diet Fix and dietary organization.
Great stuff. Dr. Yanni Friedhoff joins us. Dr. Friedhoff, you know, one thing in your book that was quite prevalent and the fact that you're not totally against any of the diets out there. You have fundamental, I guess, rules you like to follow, but there's not a wrong diet. There's not one diet that's better than another diet. You're talking about taking the diet that a person is interested in following and making it work in their lifestyle. That's sort of the whole idea behind the Diet Fix.
Absolutely. You know, I think that all diets can be tweaked and modified to sort of work for a person. And there's plenty of people out there who were on one or another particular diet that worked for a while and then stopped working. And if there is a way for that individual to figure out what went wrong and to tweak it, they may be able to resurrect one of their lives' most successful short-term efforts and turn it into a long-term effort. And that was my hope with the Diet Fix, is to give some principles that can be overlaid on top of any diet or used on their own to help somebody lose weight. But again, as I mentioned with the National Weight Control Registry, people lose weight all sorts of different ways. Who am I to tell somebody, you know, that there's a specific way of eating that is the best one? What's best for me might not be best for somebody else, sometimes because of cultural differences, sometimes because of different palates or real life circumstances in terms of job requirements, caregiving requirements. There's a lot of things that affect our choices from a dietary perspective, and to pigeonhole somebody into one way to go, I think, is a great way to ensure that lots of people fail long term.
We're talking with Dr. Yanni Friedhoff, family doctor and author of The Diet Fix, Why Diets Don't Work and How to Make Yours Work. Dr. Friedhoff, your book is broken down very smart. It's easy to read, easy to follow. It starts off with a reveal for the 10-day reset, has a recovery phase, great recipes. And inside of this, you've got a very interesting breakdown of things that you think are important. I really like the idea of the seven deadly sins of dieting, the dieting seven deadly traumas, and, you know, the traumatic dieting disorders. You've broken sort of these in down to really usable, easy to read sort of segments that can be really helpful for everybody out there.
I mean, I think that if you're going to make changes, understanding why you're making them is crucial. And some programs and approaches just tell somebody this is what you need to do. I think it's important to empower people to understand why they're being told what they're being told. And so the Diet Fix starts off with some explanations of why I came up with the concepts and the philosophy that I espouse. Then how do you employ it into your real life? And then the last section, which I call recovery, is the extended life. How do you manage on vacations? How do you manage on holidays? How do you manage with food pushes in your life? What do you do about alcohol? What about medical problems you might have? Should you consider surgeries? Are there drugs that might be impacting this? Because there really are, again, a lot of variables that will affect a person's weight.
Yeah, Dr. Friedhoff, just one last thing before we let you go here. Appreciate your time today. Just as people get ready to, you know, take on this task of managing their weight and getting it under control, understanding where they're at is really important. I thought there was one really interesting sort of statement you made in the book, and it's the fact that some studies suggest that beyond the age of 65, the healthiest body weights are statistically in the overweight range, which I thought is interesting. And also on top of that was the effectiveness of exercise, which is, you know, a lot of people have been led astray in a lot of these programs that are out there by the importance, or maybe not the importance, but the effectiveness of exercise in weight management. One study had mentioned that 91.5 hours per year to affect 1 pound of body weight change. That's an amazing number.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that if we burned huge numbers of calories through exercise, I don't think we would be here as a species, because up until very, very, very recently, there just weren't very many calories out there to eat. We grew up, so to speak, in an evolutionary perspective through times of extreme dietary insecurity. And so if we burned a whole pile of calories, you know, walking around and doing our thing, we wouldn't have been able to hunt and capture enough calories to survive. Our bodies are very efficient. They just don't burn as many calories as would be fair. And we also, as human beings, have this failing where we believe once we exercise, we deserve more calories. We deserve to eat better. And we will often eat because we exercise, which is why on paper, exercise absolutely can burn calories, but in practice, it doesn't tend to lead people to weight loss. Most experts will agree 80% of a person's modifiable weight is modifiable on the basis of dietary choices, only about 20% on the basis of fitness choices. A lot easier to lose weight in your kitchen than in your gym.
Dr. Fridoff, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate the book, and we'll look forward to following you on Weighty Matters and talking to you soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there it is. A great conversation we had a few years ago with Dr. Yanni Fridoff at the launch of his book called The Diet Fix. It's a worthy read for any parent out there, or if you're trying to get control of your health and your weight, it just has some good, sound advice. It's sort of the no BS version, and we promote this book across the board for sure. We have to thank Dr. Fridoff for all of his great work. And as the clock winds down, I also want to thank Dr. Ashley Skinner for sharing their research, The Prevalence of Obesity and Severe Obesity in Children, from Duke University. Very, very important work. Listen, in order to solve a problem, you have to have a clear idea of what the problem is. And that's exactly what Dr. Skinner and her team have done for us. They've given us a good idea of what's happening in terms of the trends. And when we look at that very important age group and the alarming statistic of the spike in severe obesity between the ages of 2 and 5 years of age, that's a warning shot across the bow, people. We have got to get the battle rolling, and we've got to do better, and we're up against it. Food is so easy to get. It's everywhere, and the big food companies are marketing to our children. So, eyes open, everybody. Stay frosty out there and be aware. That's the key. Coming up next week on Crush Performance, a very special episode as we team up with Low Tide to bring you the opening day baseball extravaganza, a 2-hour special with Crush Performance and the Lowdown with Low Tide as we map out, lay out, and talk everything baseball next week. You'll want to be there. It's going to be a fun show with some very, very special guests. So we're looking forward to that. I want to thank you guys for listening today. If you have any questions, comments, or smart remarks, write to us, crushperformance.com, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye now. Don't forget to ride.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.